You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 9th. I'm Maria from Drake University. Here's our first story. Canesville Guard Reaches Milestone by Tim Rower. For many years now, the Canesville Writers Honor Guard has offered full military honors to veterans who have passed on. It has just reached a milestone. As of this Friday, we have served 1,000 funerals, said its treasurer, Cindy Ruby. Her husband, Al Ruby, who is the group's president, added, "No veteran should be buried without full military honors." Sanctioned by the U.S. Department of Defense to perform this service, the writers have traveled many miles for offering their final respects. "We went to Kansas City, Kansas to do a funeral," Ruby said. "If a veteran passes away, we will provide full military honors. In fact, we've done 3 to 4 funerals in a day. We never turn down a funeral." Canesville Writers Honor Guard performs this tribute at no charge. It offers other services too, including helping veterans struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, which can bring on flashbacks, nightmares, severe anxiety, and other symptoms. Approximately 23% of veterans behind bars suffer from PTSD and not know how to deal with it, Ruby said. Veterans dealing with PTSD can set up an appointment with a trained counselor at the Guard's headquarters at 3000 Avenue B in Council Bluffs. "Here, veterans can come and be in a safe place," said Keith Confer, vice president. "And it's off the record. You have to learn to manage it. You have to have that push," added member Ed Kearns. The service is even available for Council Bluffs first responders, whether they are veterans or not, and city employees who are veterans, he said. Officials in the police and fire department, as well as Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh, have offered support for this service. "Mayor Walsh has been a godsend to this group," Kearns said. "He understands what this group does." The counselor, Lyle Burkle, has been employed in the mental health field for more than 40 years, including working in the Omaha Veterans Administration Hospital. Another service, which has become an annual event, is accompanying veterans on a 3-day honor flight to view veterans' memorials in Washington, D.C. This year's honors flight, the group's fourth, is scheduled to begin October 1st. Currently, more than 60 veterans have signed up for this trip, Cindy Ruby said. "This 3-day tour allows the veterans to view the sites in a relaxing, unrushed manner," she said. "It's also totally free of charge for the veterans." "It's a great experience," Cindy Ruby said. The group sponsors a gun show at a fundraiser and is always welcoming of donations to help support its mission. "You don't have to pay to be a member, and you don't have to be a veteran to join," Cindy Ruby said. "We need more support," Al Ruby added. Find more information on the group's website at canesvillehonorguard.org or through its Facebook page at facebook.com/canesvillewriters.honorguard. "It's not about us," Al Ruby said. "It's about what we do for other veterans." There's a photo attached to this, and the caption reads, "Keith Confer left, Alan Cindy Ruby, and Ed Kearns are members of the Canesville Writer Honor Guard. The group performs full military honors at veterans' funerals and is currently in preparation for accompanying local veterans on another honor flight this fall. It also provides counseling services for veterans suffering from PTSD." And there's a photo here of 4 individuals. They are all wearing shades of blue, as well as all jeans. They have a flag in front of them that reads, "A Grateful Nation Remembers 1941 to 1945 World War II. It's a blue flag with 5 white stars at the top of the flag, a white circle with the red words, "A Grateful Nation Remembers," over it in following the circular pattern. And then there's a gold eagle, or I believe it's an eagle, perhaps some sort of bird, resting within the circle. There's also several flags behind them. There are 7 flags. And one of them is the United States flag. And I believe the rest of them, while standing in a way that you can't see what is exactly on the flag, I believe they are the rest of the branches of the military. Our next story is Viv Ewing Steps Down by Scott Stewart. The leader of a Council Bluffs-based nonprofit serving children and families in the metropolitan area unexpectedly stepped down Friday. Viv Ewing resigned as president and CEO of Children's Square USA, effective immediately on Friday morning. "I have decided that it is time for me to move on to new challenges and support my family as we embark on new opportunities," Ewing said in a statement provided to the Nonpareil. The Children's Square Board of Directors accepted Ewing's resignation on Friday morning and named Phil Taylor, the organization's chief administrative officer, as interim president and CEO. Taylor told the Nonpareil in an email that he couldn't provide additional comment on the sudden timing of Ewing's departure. She had been at the helm of Children's Square since January 2022. "It has been an honor and a privilege," Ewing said in the statement, noting she is immensely proud of the accomplishments during her tenure. Together, we have made significant strides in advancing our mission and serving our community. I want to express my gratitude to the board of directors, staff, volunteers, and supporters. Ewing is an Omaha native who has a doctorate from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in community and human resources, a master's degree in urban studies, and a bachelor's degree in public administration from the University of Nebraska at Omaha. She has more than 20 years of executive leadership with nonprofits, including as CEO of the Alzheimer's Association. She's previously worked for the now-defunct Promise Ship, Habitat for Humanity, Salvation Army Croc Center, and Omaha Housing Authority. Taylor has deep roots with Children's Square, including as a volunteer in its emergency shelter and as a board chair from 2014 to 2016. He and his wife were foster parents and adopted their daughter through Children's Square. He started working for the nonprofit in August 2022. A native of Illinois, Taylor holds an Executive Master of Business Administration degree from the UNL. He was previously the general manager of the Nonpareil before serving as president of the Omaha World Herald. Before joining Children's Square, he was the vice president of sales and marketing and Omaha market president of Five Nines Technology Group. I am honored that the board has asked me to serve in this role, Taylor said in a news release. Children's Square provides critical services that bring healing and hope to children with mental and behavioral health needs. We will continue to provide services that make a positive impact on the lives of our children and families in our community. The 141-year-old organization is based in Council Bluffs with a presence in Omaha. It serves children with mental and behavioral health needs. Each day, it provides more than 1,000 youth and family counseling, emergency services, early childhood care, foster care, and residential treatment. Well, good luck to Mr. Taylor. Our next story covers psychiatric care, for-profit trend. There's a photo here that the caption reads, a for-profit company has proposed remodeling a vacant nursing home building in Grinnell into a 60-bed psychiatric hospital. If the project moves forward, it would become the third privately owned, standalone psychiatric hospital to open in the state since 2020. And there's a photo here, which I assume is this nursing home building that will be turned into a psychiatric hospital, should be approved. There is a brick building behind with an American flag waving in front of it. In the forefront, there is a sign that says Grinnell Healthcare. There is a very large red G in the middle of the sign, and then the words Grinnell Healthcare Center are overlaying that. In front of the sign are some small little hedges to make it seem more natural to the environment. This story is by Tony Lays. A for-profit company has proposed turning a boarded-up former nursing home here into a psychiatric hospital, joining a national trend towards having such hospitals owned by investors instead of by state government or nonprofit health systems. The companies see a business opportunity in the shortage of inpatient beds for people with severe mental illness. The scarcity of inpatient psychiatric care is evident nationwide, especially in rural areas. People in crisis often are held for days or weeks in emergency rooms or jails, then transported far from their hometowns when a bed opens in a distant hospital. 8 nonprofit Iowa hospitals have shuttered their psychiatric units since 2007, often citing staffing and financial challenges. Iowa closed 2 of its 4 mental health institutions, including the one in Clarinda, in 2015. The state now ranks last in the nation for access to state-run psychiatric hospitals, according to the Treatment Advocacy Center. The national group, which promotes improving care for people with severe mental illness, recommends states have at least 50 state-run psychiatric beds per 100,000 people. Iowa has just 2 beds per 100,000 residents, the group said. 2 out of state companies have developed psychiatric hospitals in Iowa in the past 4 years, and now a third company has obtained a state certificate of need to open a 60-bed facility in Grinnell. Before 2020, Iowa had no privately owned, freestanding psychiatric hospitals, but several national companies specialize in developing such facilities, which treat people in crisis for conditions such as depression, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder, sometimes compounded by drug or alcohol abuse. One of the companies operating in Iowa, Universal Health Services, says it has mental health facilities in 39 states. Lisa Daly, the Treatment Advocacy Center's executive director, said for-profit hospitals don't necessarily provide worse care than nonprofit ones, but they tend to be less transparent and more motivated by money. Private facilities are private, she said. As a result, you may not have a great insight into why they make the decisions that they make. Daly said solid data on privately run mental health hospitals nationwide is scarce, but she has heard for-profit companies have recently set up freestanding psychiatric hospitals in several states, including California. The California Department of Public Health confirmed 3 such facilities have opened there since 2021 in El Oviedo, Madera, and Sacramento. The latest Iowa psychiatric hospital would be housed in a vacant nursing home on the outskirts of Grinnell, a college town of 9,500 people in a rural region of the state. The project's developers noted that there are no other inpatient mental health facilities in Poweshiek County, where Grinnell is located, or in any of the eight surrounding counties. The nearest inpatient mental health facilities are 55 miles west in Des Moines. The Indiana-based company proposing the hospital, Hickory Recovery Network, primarily runs addiction treatment centers in Indiana, but it opened psychiatric hospitals in Ohio and Texas in 23 and 2024. And it told Iowa regulators it could open the Grinnell Hospital by August. An affiliated company ran the facility as a nursing home called the Grinnell Healthcare Center until 2022, according to a Hickory Recovery Network filing with Iowa regulators. Medicare rated the nursing home's overall quality at just 2 out of 5 stars. And in 2020, the facility was suspended indefinitely from Iowa's Medicaid program because of billing issues, state records show. Officials from Hickory Recovery Network responded only briefly to KFF Health News inquiries, including about how the former Iowa nursing home's spotty record could affect the proposed psychiatric hospital. In a short telephone interview in February, Melissa Durkin, the company's chief operating officer, declined to say who owns Hickory Recovery Network. Durkin denied in the interview that her organization was associated with the company that ran the defunct and troubled Grinnell nursing home. However, Hickory Recovery's application for a certificate of need refers to the nursing home's operator as Hickory's affiliated company. In testimony before Iowa regulators, Durkin made a similar reference as she expressed confidence her organization could find sufficient staff to reopen the facility as a psychiatric hospital. "We have a history with that building. We operated a nursing home there before," she said at the video recorded hearing. Durkin said in the interview that company leaders had not decided for sure to redevelop the vacant Iowa nursing home into a psychiatric hospital, although they twice went through the complicated process of applying for a state certificate of need for the project. The first attempt was stymied in 2023 by a tie vote of the board that considers such permits, which are a major hurdle for large healthcare projects. The second application was approved by a unanimous vote after a hearing on January 25th. Carrie Lynn Powers, a Hickory executive, told regulators the company planned to spend $1.5 million to remodel the building. The main change would include making rooms safe for people who might be suicidal, she said. The company predicted in its application that 90% of the hospital's patient revenues would come from Medicare or Medicaid, public programs for seniors or people who have low income or disabilities. It doesn't mention that the nursing home was suspended from Iowa's Medicaid program, which covers about half of the state's nursing home residents. Iowa authorities suspended the Grinnell Healthcare Center nursing home in 2020 for failing to repay nearly $25,000 in overpayments from Medicaid, state records show. When the nursing home closed in 2022, its former medical director told the local newspaper part of the reason for its demise was its inability to collect Medicaid reimbursements. Iowa administrators recently notified the owner that the former nursing home owed $284,676 to Medicaid. A state spokesperson said in March that neither amount had been repaid. The proposal to reopen the building as a psychiatric hospital won support from patient advocates, Grinnell's nonprofit community hospital, and the regional mental health coordinator. The only opposition at the state hearing came from Kevin Petit, leader of one of Iowa's two other private freestanding psychiatric hospitals. Petit is chief executive officer of Clive Behavioral Health Hospital, a 100-bed facility in suburban Des Moines that opened in 2021. Petit told regulators he supports expanding mental health services, but he predicted the proposed Grinnell facility would struggle to hire qualified employees. He said despite strong demand for care, many Iowa psychiatric facilities are limiting admissions. The beds exist, but they're not actually open because we're dealing with staffing issues throughout the state, Petit testified. Overall, Iowa has 901 licensed inpatient mental health beds, including in psychiatric units at community hospitals, in freestanding psychiatric hospitals, and in the two remaining state mental health institutes, according to the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services. But as of January, just 738 of those beds were staffed and being used. Petit's facility is run by Pennsylvania-based University Health Services in partnership with Mercy One, a hospital system based in the Des Moines area. In an interview, Petit said his hospital only has enough staff to use about half of its beds. He says it's especially difficult to recruit nurses and therapists, even in an urban area with a relatively robust labor supply. State inspectors have cited problems at the Clive facility, including 4 times declaring that deficiencies put patient safety in immediate jeopardy. Those issues included insufficient staff to properly monitor patients and insufficient safeguards to prevent access to items patients could use to choke or cut themselves. Petit said such citations are not unusual in the tightly regulated industry. He said the organization is committed to patient safety. We value the review by our regulatory entities during the survey process and view any finding as an opportunity for continuous improvement of our operations, he wrote in an email. Iowa's other privately owned psychiatric hospital, Eagle View Behavioral Health in Bettendorf, also has been cited by state inspectors. The 72-bed hospital was purchased in 2022 by Summit BHC from Strategic Behavioral Health, which opened the facility in 2020. Both companies are based in Tennessee. State inspectors have cited the Bettendorf facility twice for two issues posing immediate jeopardy to patient safety. In 2023, inspectors cited the facility for insufficient supervision of patients, resulting in inappropriate sexual activity between adult and adolescent patients. In 2021, the facility was cited for insufficient safety checks to prevent suicide attempts and sexual misconduct. EagleView officials did not respond to requests for comment. Advocates for Iowa patients have supported the development of freestanding psychiatric hospitals. Leslie Carpenter of Iowa City, whose adult son has been hospitalized repeatedly for severe mental illness, spoke in favor of the Grinnell's facility application for a certificate of need. In an interview afterwards, Carpenter said she was optimistic the new facility could find enough staff to help address Iowa's critical shortage of inpatient psychiatric care. She said she would keep a close eye on how the new facility fares. I think if a company were willing to come in and do the job well, it could be a game changer. Our next story is a short blurb titled Lawmakers Pass Drunken Driving Restrictions, and this is from the Lee Gazette Des Moines Bureau. A bill aimed at improving ignition interlock law for those convicted of drunken driving is headed to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk. Senate File 2261 passed the House last week 87-7. It would require those convicted of drunken driving to complete the designated time period without violations before the device can be removed and the driver's license reinstated. The period of a time a person is required to maintain an ignition interlock device on their vehicle would be extended by an additional 60 days for 10 or more violations within a 30-day period, 5 or more violations within a 24-hour period, or for tampering with, removing, or attempting to circumvent the device without authorization. The bill is supported by Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Supporters say the legislation is critical to reducing impaired driving in Iowa. Currently, a person whose driver's license is revoked for operating while intoxicated is required to install the device before being issued a temporary restricted license. The small, handheld breathalyzer used to prevent users from being able to start their vehicle after drinking alcohol must be installed on every vehicle owned or operated by the person, or every vehicle operated by the person if they have no previous OWI conviction. The bill would instead require an ignition interlock only on vehicles they drive. A person would be able to wait out their 180-day license suspension for conviction of OWI first offense and would not be required to get an ignition interlock if they do not drive during that period. The bill also allows individuals to waive their requirement to install an interlock device for a verifiable medical condition that makes the person incapable of properly operating the device. It also establishes in code the alcohol concentration beyond which a device will not allow the operator of the motor vehicle at 0.04. The DOT would be required to revoke the driver's license of a person required to maintain an ignition interlock device who does not get one installed or removes it without authorization. All right, our next story is in honor of National Walking Week, and it is by Joe Shearer. Walk the Bluffs Trailblazers hold joint event. Last week was National Walking Week, and walking clubs from both sides of the river came together to celebrate the occasion Thursday morning. Walk the Bluffs, also known as the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club, joined up with members of the Nebraska Wander Freund Trailblazers at the First Avenue Trail. The city of Council Bluffs recently unveiled 4 new murals, all of which can be seen from the trail, and the club got to see some public art while walking around 3 miles. Carrie McDonald, owner of First Row Fitness and Walk the Bluffs organizer, said the Trailblazers contacted her late last year to try and set up a group walk, and her club's first walking session of the season lining up with the National Walk Week seemed like the perfect time to collaborate. They wanted to see the new murals put up along the First Avenue Trail, she said. It was great. It turned out to be a beautiful day. McDonald started Walk the Bluffs a year ago with the simple mission of getting people on their feet for their health while also getting to know other members of the community. She said she noticed many familiar faces from last year, and it was exciting hosting the Trailblazers to give them a taste of Council Bluffs' robust trail system. The Nebraska Wander Freund Trailblazers group was formed in 1979 and is one of the first clubs entered into the American Volksport Association. Trailblazers president, Lori Anderson, said her club's goal is to provide fun, fitness, and friendship to its members. McDonald said that while not everyone can handle strenuous exercise, the simple act of walking provides numerous benefits. It's all about movement and getting our heart rate up, she said. If we go on a handful of 20-minute walks within our week and push ourselves to a pace where we feel like we're breathing a little harder, we're going to reap the benefits of that movement. The American Heart Association says 150 minutes of brisk walking per week can lead to improved physical and mental health. Walking helps reduce the risk of diseases like heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and different cancers. It also improves blood cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugar, while increasing energy and stamina. Boosted bone strength and weight gain prevention are other benefits. As far as mental health, the association says walking improves memory and reduces the risk of dementia, and it also strengthens mental and emotional well-being. The next Walk the Bluff session will take place on the Riverfront Trail System at 10:45 a.m. on Saturday, April 13th. Walkers will meet up at the steps of Tom Hannafin River's Edge Park. Walk the Bluffs meets every Saturday at trails in and around the city. Every walk is an hour long and starts at 10:45 a.m. The group also hosts monthly hikes. They are 90 to 120 minutes long and start at 9 a.m. The schedule with times can be found on the Walk the Bluffs Facebook. There are three pictures that come with this story. The first one is a great picture that it reads, artist Bettany Kalk's mural, Rails to Trip, Evolution of Transportation, is seen in the background as members of the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club, and the Nebraska Wander Freund Trailblazers hike along the First Avenue Trail during a Walk the Bluff session celebrating National Walking Week on Thursday. It's a great photo. There's three people in the forefront of this photo, a couple people moving in and out of frame. These three people are wearing heavy coats, one of them blue, one of them gray, and one of them a dark olive green. And they're also in jeans and hats, so might have been a little chillier on this day, but they're still out there excited to go walking. Behind them is a tree that needs some blossoms, so hopefully spring is coming soon. And then the mural behind them. The mural is gorgeous. There are pink and yellow flowers bursting from the ground, a beautiful blue sky with some white clouds. And then there is also a couple bumblebees flying through the mural on the painting, not in the photo. And so it's exciting to see a hint of spring in this mural that will hopefully become jump off the mural and into the park soon. There's another photo here that says artist Weston Thompson's mural, Dream Builder, is seen in the background as members of the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club and the Nebraska Wanderers Freund Trailblazer hike along the First Avenue Trail. So more people hiking, walking in their jackets and jeans. These people are wearing sunglasses, so despite the cold, it was a sunny day. The mural behind them is lots of colors, a lot of blues and oranges, and it's a little abstract, so the shapes overlap with one another. There seems to be a cursive word on there as well. However, I can't read it behind all the walkers. And then finally, the Omaha skyline is seen in the background as members of the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club and the Nebraska Wander Freund Trailblazers hike along the first trail, our First Avenue Trail, during a Walk the Bluff session celebrating National Walking Week on Thursday, April 4th, 2024. And then here, it's a farther back shot. You can see the Omaha skyline. There are three or four buildings that peek out. One of them says Woodman Life, a building I'm not familiar with. Another one looks more like a skyscraper. Another building has an American flag flying over it. And then in the forefront, there are people walking along a sidewalk with a stop sign and a no motor vehicles so that they can remain safe. And they are walking towards the beginning, towards the photographer who's taking the photo. It's a great shot. All right, and a story that deeply intrigued me is key springtime pet safety tips. Warmer weather can create animal hazards. And this is by Mariah Garcia from the Midlands Humane Society. Spring has officially sprung, and with the warmer weather, our thoughts turn to spending more time outdoors with our pets, longer walks around the neighborhood, and of course, gardening, spring cleaning, and all the home improvement projects you've been waiting to get started on. Before jumping right into springtime activities, keep in mind potential hazards for your furry friends. Keep reading for tips from the ASPCA on keeping your pets safe this spring. Safe screening. Many pet parents welcome the breezy days of spring by opening their windows. Be sure to install snug safe screening. Many pets parents welcome their breezy days of spring by opening their windows. Be sure to install snug and sturdy screens in all your windows as pets, especially the feline variety, are apt to jump or fall through unscreened windows. Spring cleaning. When the snow has melted and the birds start singing, many people feel the pull of deep cleaning the house after a long winter indoors. Be sure to keep all cleaners and chemicals out of your pet's way, as almost all cleaning products, including all natural ones, contain chemicals that can be harmful to pets. Follow labels on the container for proper use and storage. The SPCA Animal Poison Control Center has a full list of poisonous household products at their website, aspca.org/petcare/animal poison control. Home Improvement 101. Products such as paints, mineral, spirits, and solvents can be toxic to your pets and cause severe irritation or chemical burns. Also be cautious of physical hazards such as nails, staples, insulation, blades, and power tools. Consider confining your pet to a designated pet-friendly room while home improvement projects are being completed. Growing gardens. Always store fertilizers, insecticides, and herbicides in an out-of-the-way place and follow the label instructions carefully. Many popular springtime plants, including rhododendrons and azaleas, are highly toxic to pets and can prove fatal if eaten. Fleas and ticks, pesky parasites start appearing during spring as the weather warms up. Ensure your beloved companion on year-round heartworm prevention medicine and flea and tick prevention. Keeping the outside of your house free of or organic debris like rake clippings and leaves can help prevent fleas since they prefer to hide in dark, moist, and shady areas. Allergy alert! Did you know Fido and Fluffy can have seasonal allergies too? Like us, pets can be allergic to foods, dust, plants, and pollens. Allergic reactions in pets can cause itching, sniffling, sneezing, or life-threatening anaphylactic shock to insect bites and stings. If you suspect your pet has a springtime allergy, please visit your veterinarian. ID tags. More time spent outdoors means an increased risk of your pet going on a solo adventure around the neighborhood. Make sure your pet has a microchip for identification and wears a tag with your contact information. MHS offers microchipping for the low cost of $27.50 with no appointment needed. Now go out and enjoy that beautiful weather with your furry friend. All right. And then there are some photos attached to this one that include our MHS Pets of the Week. Calling all Lagomorph lovers out there, MHS has several New Zealand and giant chinchilla bunnies that were born in foster care on February 16th. They are tolerant of handling and are all highly social. These are giant breed rabbits that will require a very large enclosure, typically a spare bedroom. They are all spayed, neutered, and microchipped. And we have these bunnies. They are in a photo. They're on a blue blanket with a white wall behind them. They are a light tan and white. There's two bunnies. One is in the back. One's more in the forefront of the photo. And the one in the forefront of the photo is looking right at the camera and has giant ears that are very up and alert. They're very cute. Sadie. Sadie is a 2-year-old spayed female labradoodle who is looking for that special someone to help her build confidence and to get some more life experience. She is very nervous in the shelter environment and will need a patient owner who will give her plenty of time to come out of her shell. With some TLC, we are confident Sadie will gain self-esteem and become ready to take on the world with you. And Sadie is in a photo on a concrete ground with a fence in the background. She is a beautiful golden dog with lots of fur. Her ears are flapping in the wind. And so she does look a little nervous in the photo, but I know that she'll go to a forever home, hopefully. And then finally, we have Miss Kitty. Miss Kitty is a 3-year-old spayed female domestic short hair who is ready to find the sunset spot to relax in her new home. She absolutely loves being brushed and getting plenty of attention. She will benefit from a bit of a diet as she is a bit chunky. MHS is open weekdays from noon to 6 p.m. and Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. You can view our adoptable pets by visiting our website at midlandhumanesociety.org/adopt. And Miss Kitty is a good-looking gal. She is a white cat with a gray tail and gray ears. Perhaps the person taking this photo had a bit of food in their hands because she is looking straight up at the camera. She has gorgeous light green eyes, like a spring green. And I know that she is going to fit in right at home with a little bit of attitude wherever she ends up. But she is a good-looking kitty cat. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 9th, or IRIS. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Maria from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. And now we move to obituaries. Okay, we have 4 obituaries today. The first one reads, is William L., who went by Bill Smith. He was born on November 29th, 1941, and passed last week on April 4th, 2024. William L. Bill Smith, age 82, of Council Bluffs, passed away April 4th, 2024, at Rising Sun Christian Village. Bill was born November 29th, 1941, in Council Bluffs, to the late Harry and Margaret Christofferson Smith. He graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1960 and proudly served his country in the Iowa National Guard. Bill married Judy Kamau on June 1, 1960 in Council Bluffs. They were blessed with two daughters, Cheryl and Shelley. Bill was a carpenter, home builder of Smith Custom Homes, real estate broker, and owner of Century 21 Realty Center and the Realty Center. He was a member of Salem United Methodist Church. In addition to his parents, Bill was preceded in death by his grandson, Micah Thomas, brother, Jack Smith, sisters, Marjorie Pickenpaw, Jacqueline Achenbach, Shirley Lee, and Norma Leeper. Bill is survived by his wife, Judy Smith, daughters, Sherry Thomas, Shelley, Tom Valdesari, five grandchildren, Jacob, Julie, Zachary, Samantha, and Rachel, four great-grandchildren, Claire, Ava, Elle, Ella, and Caleb, sister, Betty, and John Smith, sister-in-law, Jenny Smith, nieces and nephews. Memorial service will be Thursday at 2 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment in Ridgewood Cemetery with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center, 1350 East Pierce St. Visitation. Interment in Ridgewood Cemetery with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center, 1350 East Pierce Street. Visitation with the family Thursday, 1:30 p.m. to 2 p.m. at the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to the Pace Center or Salem United Methodist Church. Here we have John R. Wendell, born on November 16, 1953 to January 7, 2024. Omaha. Memorial Mass, Friday, April 12, 2024, 10:30 a.m. at Corpus Christi Catholic Church, 3304 4th Avenue, Council Bluffs. Interment will follow in Omaha National Cemetery with military rites tendered by the Canesville Honor Guard. A lunch will follow at Corpus Christi Catholic Church. Memorials are suggested to Food Bank for the Heartland. And we have Beverly Joy Lauver, May 24, 1932 to March 5, 2024. Beverly Joy Lauver, age 91, passed away on March 5, 2024 in Roche, Missouri. Services to be held Saturday, April 13, 2024 at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home at 11:30 a.m. And our final obituary, Reverend Richard Allen Peterson, September 23, 1931 to April 3, 2024. Services will be on Wednesday, April 10th at 11 a.m. at Benson Baptist Church in Omaha, Nebraska. To view full obituary, visit www.hefehefe.com. And there's a quote here at the bottom of the obituaries that I really like. When someone you love becomes a memory, the memory becomes a treasure. Unknown. And now we'll move over to... All right, no surprise that lots of sports today still are covering University of Iowa's own Caitlin Clark. However, we're going to start with something a little different. TJ Girls Soccer Invitational, Saints Eagles Cards Go 2-0 by Peter Burnett. Thomas Jefferson hosted their annual invitation at Gale Wickersham Athletic Complex. Here are the results from the matches. 1A, number 6, Underwood 2, 3A, number 12, CB Lincoln 0. A Remy Paulson brace scoring on both sides of halftime led the Eagles to win over the Lynx. Trainer 3, South Sioux City 0. A pair of goals by Claire Schrag lifted Trainer in a clash of the Cardinals. Ellie Kinsella also scored. 1A, number 12, St. Albert 7, Sioux City West 0. Ella Klusman poured in 4 goals while Lily Crone added 2 and Eleanor Coughlin scored 1. Sophie Sheffield kept a clean sheet and goal. Good for Ella. That's impressive. And the rest of the team. CB Jefferson 7, Carroll 0. Taylan Miner led the Yellow Jackets with 2 goals and 2 assists. McKenna Kramer and Kaylee Driggers added 1 of each, while Demi Payne, Ava Reef, and Samantha Urbank scored the other goals for TJ. Grace Strong picked up an assist, and Cameron Hosick picked up her 3rd clean sheet of the season. Southeast Polk 2, Glenwood 0. And then finally, 3A, number 2, Waukee Northwest 6, 2A, number 12, Lewis Central 0. The Titans were blanked by the Wolves in their first game of the day. Reese Rodgers scored twice for Waukee Northwest. And then here we have a photo, Sioux City's North Marissa McNeil 5 defends St. Albert's Ella Klusman 1 near the North Stars goal during the Thomas Jefferson Girls Invitational at Gale Wickersham Athletic Complex on Saturday. This is a great action shot. We have the goalie is in a very bright lime green. We have two girls who are from North Stars in red and blue striped jerseys, one wearing a number 5. And then we have two girls in white jerseys and black shorts in their with green numbers on their jerseys. And one of the girls in white is kicking the ball, hopefully, right into the goal. So don't know how that photo ends, but it's a great shot as well. All right, the big headline in the sports section reads, She's got game. And the caption of the photo reads, Iowa's Caitlin Clark pauses as she speaks during a press conference before practice for the NCAA Women's Championship game on Saturday in Cleveland. And it is the one we know and love, Caitlin Clark, in a gray hoodie with the Iowa Hawkeyes logo on the left corner, and then of course the Nike swoosh on the right, and then she's speaking into a March Madness branded microphone with a March Madness and Iowa branded backdrop behind her. This photo is by Will Graves. He's an AP national writer, and it reads, Clark sets out to make Iowa a winner, redefined women's hoops in the process. Caitlin Clark doesn't want to think about it or doesn't want to talk about it. That will come later, probably much later. Yes, the Iowa star sees the pack stands, hears the pop in the crowd whenever she drops in another three-pointer from the logo, senses the throng of media around her. Doesn't need to be reminded that her name has been trending pretty much everywhere over 4 months that have transformed her life and, in some ways, her sport. The reality is the leading all-time scorer in NCAA Division I history envisioned some of this. A year ago, after a painful loss to LSU in the national title game, Clark's lone focus was finding a way back. One paradigm-shifting season later, that moment arrived Sunday. And while it ended just the way last year's final against LSU did, with Clark and the Hawkeyes walking off the floor amid confetti that fell for others, as South Carolina celebrated its second title in 3 years, she tried to keep it in perspective. Yes, she wanted to win. Badly. And she played like it, particularly during a first quarter in which she poured in 18 points, a record for most points in a quarter in an NCAA final. Yet the deep and relentless Gamecocks wore Clark and the Hawkeyes down. She finished with 30 in all before checking out with 20 seconds to go, receiving a long, loud ovation and a hug from Coach Lisa Bluter. There were no tears, not publicly anyway. Instead, there was just an appreciation for a remarkable journey few deemed possible when she arrived on campus 4 years ago. The emotions will probably hit me over the next couple of days, Clark said. I don't have much time to sit around and sulk and be upset. I don't think that's what I'm about either. Yeah, I'm sad we lost this game, but I'm also so proud of myself. I'm so proud of my teammates. I'm so proud of this program. There's a lot to be proud of. Clark's impact. The evidence of how far Clark and women's college basketball have come has been everywhere over the last month. Nowhere more so than at a Final Four laden with star power both on the court and in the stands. The arena was nearly full when Clark's now iconic number 22 made its way onto the floor for Iowa's open practice on Saturday. Jogging out to meet her teammates in a black jersey, shorts, and socks, she casually sank a three-pointer from the wing for the first time she touched the ball, a splash through the net that was met with an audible volume spike. It was that way over the course of 50 mostly informal minutes. The cameras in the arena never wandered too far. The crowd never really went silent, and never really does when Clark is involved. It's been that way for a while now. She has navigated it all with an uncommon polish, welcoming the spotlight only because it gives her the power to point it in whatever direction she chooses. Clark doesn't view herself as one of one, but a part of a burgeoning ecosystem within women's sports. Sure, a record 14.2 million turned in to watch Iowa's win over UConn on Friday night, but she doesn't view it as a one-off. I think you see it across the board, whether it's softball, whether it's gymnastics, volleyball, Clark said. People want to watch. It's just when they've given the opportunity, the research and the facts show that people love it. And they love Clark in particular, a full circle moment for Clark she never saw coming. As a kid, she remembers being part of the gymmermania that surrounded former BYU sharpshooter. As a kid, she remembers being part of the gymmermania that surrounds former BYU sharpshooter Jimmer Fredrett. Now, she's the one with kids in the stands wearing t-shirts in her likeness. She's the one who's created a fiefdom of sorts, selling out basketball games wherever she laces up her black and yellow Nikes. It's all a bit strange, if only because this was never her intention. Growing up, she dreamed of helping Iowa chase down the women's basketball powers that be. Now, she and the Hawkeyes have elbowed their way among the sports elite. That was always the goal, not all that she had surprisingly come with it. The commercials, the name drops from hoop royalty like LeBron James and Steph Curry, and the way she's helped make women's basketball accessible to an audience that long considered it an afterthought, if it considered it at all. It can be dizzying. She has tried, however, to keep it in perspective, stressing whenever she can that this thing, whatever it is hardly just about her. It's about those who came before and those who will come after. It's a group that is rapidly expanding. As Clark and the Hawkeyes went through a walkthrough that doubled as a celebration for how far they've come, a young girl held up a sign that said, I used to play soccer, now I hoop. She's hardly alone. I genuinely believe every time that Caitlin breaks a record or comes off a game, there are thousands of boys and girls out shooting and wanting to be 22. Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said, thousands. What's next? The original is ready to cede the stage, at least at this level, to others. It's a moment Clark knows is coming, even though she's made it a point to not get ahead of herself. Getting too caught up in the lastness of everything would take too much energy for the task at hand. I know what's next is soon, she said Sunday, but at the same time, I'm not blind to the fact I need to enjoy this. I need to soak this in. The WNBA draft, where Clark is expected to be taken first overall by the Indiana Fever, awaits on April 15th, a little more than a week away. Then maybe some time with Team USA before the Paris Olympics. It's been a whirlwind. It will be a whirlwind. It will be time to reflect down the road. Sunday marked the end of one part of her life. Next week begins the start of another. She's hopeful the people that made their way into the tent stick around for what's to come. I don't really get offended when people say I never watched women's basketball before, she said. I think, one, you're a little late to the party, but yes. But two, that's cool. We're changing the game. We're attracting more people to it. People that watched to root for her. People that watched to root against her. People that watched out of curiosity. People that watched out of wonder. Clark doesn't really care how or why they came along for the ride. It simply matters that they did, and that means more than any net-cutting ceremony ever could. The way people are not only showing up, but cheering about the game and invested in the game. They understand the game, she said. They know what's going on. They're passionate about it. To me, that's the coolest thing. That's the Caitlin Clark thing. All right, and here's another perspective on the women's NCAA March Madness Championship game. Clark comes up second again. The caption reads, Caitlin Clark, 22, of the Iowa Hawkeyes, reacts in the second half during the 2024 NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament National Championship game against the South Carolina Gamecocks at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse on Sunday, April 7th, 2024 in Cleveland. It's a great photo of Caitlin in her Iowa Hawkeyes jersey. It's a black jersey with yellow lettering that reads Iowa, and of course her number 22. She is mid-clap, probably getting cheering on teammates from a big moment or a big stand. Undefeated South Carolina captures national title over Iowa, by Abby Schnabel. Before the fans had even entered Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse, Caitlin Clark was on the court. There were 80 minutes until tip-off against South Carolina. She took a deep breath and then motioned to one of the managers on the court for the ball. She was the only Iowa player on the court, but she went through her routine of taking shots from under the hoop, then the block, the free throw line, and the three-point line. Clark was in the locker room by the time the fans started to trickle in. When she emerged with the rest of her teammates, the Iowa contingent was loud despite being speckled throughout the arena. She was at this stage last year, just against a different team, LSU, after getting past the same South Carolina team in the Final Four. The Tigers ended up winning the championship title, but Clark wasn't too upset about the result, as she knew she'd have another go of it. Her emotions were different this time around. It's her last year in the yellow and gold. No matter the result, it was her final game as a collegiate player. It's hard when your season ends, no matter what stage it is, Clark said. Then it's hard when you make it to the national title game and you're so close to accomplishing something so great. I didn't want this to end. But end it did. Despite an amazing start for the Hawkeyes, South Carolina came out victorious 87-75. Clark and Iowa once again were the runner-ups. Finishing national runner-up 2 years in a row is an amazing feat, Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. Nobody thought we were going to be here at the beginning of the year, so that makes it pretty special. It's tough, but I know how hard it is to get here, too. For us to be national runner-ups 2 years in a row, that's pretty good, too. Clark hugged each and every member on the bench after checking out with 20.2 to go. While South Carolina celebrated at center court, Clark held her head high as confetti rained down. She thanked the fans one last time and received a litany of applause. She never hung her head as she walked through the tunnel. It's certainly been a special year, Clark said. To be honest, after last year, it was kind of like, how do we top doing what we did last year? Somehow, some way, every single person in our locker room believed. To be honest, this year is probably more special than last year. The teams we had to go through to get to this point, to be back in this position and come out here and battle. I mean, South Carolina is so good. There's only so much you can do. The fans went wild when Clark scored her first points of the game, a three-pointer right in front of the South Carolina bench. It got even louder when she made one of her famous logo shots 1 minute and 7 seconds later. Her 18-point first quarter performance ended on a 5-0 run, and Clark even cracked a smile as she walked over to the bench. She was quieted by the Gamecocks' defense, specifically Raven Johnson, in the second quarter, finishing just 1-for-6 from the field. Led by Camilla Cardoso and Tessa Johnson's combined 14 points, South Carolina outscored Iowa 29-19. Hannah Stolke's 9 points kept the Hawkeyes in the mix, and they only trailed by 3 points at halftime. Don't let Clark score, Raven Johnson said of her mindset. I was ready for the moment, and I take defense very hard. I take it to heart. I studied her moves, and I was ready. I had confidence this year. I told myself last year is not going to happen again. The Gamecocks held the lead for the entirety of the third quarter. The closest Iowa got was when Clark dusted off Johnson for a layup with 4 minutes and 44 seconds to go. But Ashlyn Watkins responded by kicking off an 11-2 run that gave South Carolina an 11-point lead. Cindy Affolter scored to cut it to 68-59 at the end of the quarter. Iowa had no answer for South Carolina as the lead extended to as many as 14 points. Clark and Gabby Marshall hit back-to-back three-pointers to make it a 6-point game with 6 minutes and 43 seconds remaining. Affolter cutting it to 5 points after capitalizing an on-and-off opportunity, but that's the closest the Hawkeyes would get to their national championship dream, as their national championship dreams slipped away while the clock ticked down to zero. "I'm just proud of our resiliency," Clark said. "We go into the fourth quarter, I think we cut it to 5, and we just weren't able to come up with a few stops and a few baskets. That speaks to our team. That's the story it's been all year long. My whole entire career, we never give up. We just keep fighting." Clark didn't necessarily need a national championship to cement her name as a legend in the sport. She's already accomplished so much in her 4 years with the team. She's been named Player of the Year twice. She's a 3-time unanimous first-team All-American. She broke the all-time scoring record for both men's and women's college basketball. The attention she's drawn from fans and media has raised the sport to a level never seen before. Friday's semifinal against UConn pulled in 14.2 million viewers on ESPN, peaking at 17 million. It was ESPN's highest audience for any basketball game on record and the network's second-best non-football telecast ever. The championship game is expected to surpass that number. "I played basketball at this university for 4 years," Clark said. "For it to come down to two games and that be whether or not I'm proud of myself and proud of the way I've carried myself and people are proud of the way I've impacted people in their lives, I don't think that's a fair assessment." And the impact showed even on Sunday, as Clark finished with 30 points in front of a sellout crowd of 18,300 people. Even the fans who weren't supporting a specific team were clearly louder and in favor of Clark and the Hawkeyes. Even South Carolina coach Dawn Staley took the time to shout out Clark, both on the broadcast immediately after the game and the press conference. "I just don't want to not utilize this opportunity to thank Caitlin for what she's done for women's basketball," Staley said. "Her shoulders were heavy and getting a lot of eyeballs on our game. And sometimes as a young person, it can be a bit much, but I thought she handled it with class. I hope that every step of the ladder of success she goes and she's able to elevate whatever room she's in." But in the end, it was the dominance of an undefeated South Carolina team that won out, giving Staley her third national championship. Staley, Cardoso, Raven Johnson, and Tahina Papau were all smiles when they walked into the press conference. The Gamecocks had the advantage of being a deeper team. They played 9 different players who all had 18 or more minutes. Staley was able to preserve some of her key players even in the semifinals, and the bench absolutely dominated with 37 points to Iowa's 0. Of those 9 players, 4 scored in double figures, led by Teresa Johnson's 19 points. Cardoso's earned the title of most outstanding player with her double-double of 15 points and 17 rebounds. She led the team to a 51-29 rebounding margin, which ties for the 4th largest in an NCAA Women's Championship game. Papau and Chloe Kitts added 14 and 11 points, respectively. What a great game, and what a great story about it. And now we'll shift a little bit to high school golf. All right, high school golf. Trainer sweeps Shenandoah. Trainer picked up a sweep of Shenandoah Friday evening while Glenwood's girls team defeated Clarinda by just 1 stroke. The Lady Cardinals were led by Sophie Peterson, 48, who finished tied for first with Philly Sarah Pickens. In third was Brooke Atterbury, 56, after Shenandoah's Taylor Henderson, 57, in fourth, Leah Altsik, 58, and Molly Kaufman, 59, followed as Traymore won 221 to 227. For the boys, Trainer was led by a comfortable 159-187 win by medalist Ethan Kahns by just 1 stroke. Luke Matthews, 41, and Aaron Emke, 43, rounded out the top 4. Jay Stams carded a 45. In Clarinda, Glenwood won 222-223 as Avery Joyce and Taylor Rasmussen tied for first 47, the latter winning the tie-break hole. In Denison, the Lady Monarchs defeated Lewis Central 217-224. Underwood boys won 190-195 over Logan Magnolia as Danny Stein carded a 41 and was followed by Luke Seidler, 48, Will Tiarks, 48, Sterling Smith, 53, Nick Hackett, 54, and Leo Casson, 55. Congratulations to all the winners. All right, a little bit back to basketball. Reports. Calipari in talks with Arkansas. Longtime Kentucky coach John Calipari was in negotiations to potentially leave and take the men's basketball coaching job at Arkansas, multiple outlets reported late Sunday. Arkansas officials have been in discussions with Calipari about the opening, with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette reported, citing anonymous sources. ESPN, also citing anonymous sources, reported that Calipari is finalizing a 5-year deal. The 65-year-old Hall of Fame coach has spent the last 15 seasons at Kentucky. Athletic director Mitch Barnhart recently said Calipari would return, despite calls for his firing following the Wildcats' third consecutive early exit from the NCAA tournament. Kentucky was seeded third in March Madness, but fell 80-76 to number 14 seed Oakland in the first round. This latest loss in Pittsburgh came a year after the Wildcats were ousted in the second round, and 2 years after they were upset as a number 2 seed by 15th seeded St. Peter's in their NCAA opener. Kentucky's quick exit drew immediate calls for Calipari's firing on sports talk shows and social media, while many criticizing his reliance on so-called one-and-done freshmen and Kentucky's defensive weakness. Calipari's dismissal would have triggered a $33 million buyout under terms of a lifetime contract signed in 2019. There is no buyout if he leaves for another job. Calipari has a 410-122 record at Kentucky, including the 2012 National Championship and three other Final Four appearances in 2011, 2014, and 2015. His teams have reached the tournament 12 times in all. As we normally do at the end of every season, Coach Calipari and I have had conversations about the direction of our men's basketball program, and I can confirm that he will return for his 16th season as our head coach, Barnhart said, 5 days after the loss to Oakland. Calipari and Barnhart met privately after the season ended. That's part of athletics and dealing with that, trying to get better, trying to figure out how do we do this together, Calipari said, according to the Democrat Gazette. What do we need to do? I think one of the things I've been saying about the meeting was Mitch saying, how can I help you? What can we do to help you get to where you're trying to get this thing? And we talked about three or four things, but that's when you're coaching. Overall, Calipari has an 813-260 record in 32 seasons as a college head coach. He led UMass to the 1996 Final Four and also spent more than two seasons as coach of the New Jersey Nets before returning to the college ranks at Memphis. Eric Musselman spent the last 5 years as Arkansas coach before leaving last week to become Southern California's coach. And of course, last week was the opening week of Major League Baseball. So here we have leading off your guide to the week in Major League Baseball. Bright spot. Blanco has become loan positive in Astros' shaky start by Noah Trister of the Associated Press. There's a photo here. It says Astros starter Ronel Blanco pitches in the second inning against the Rangers on Sunday. Blanco, coming off a no-hitter, went 5 innings against Texas before giving up a hit. This is a great action shot, again, of somebody, of pitcher Blanco on the mound. He has one arm back ready to throw that baseball and the other legs astride to really get that best angle to get that ball fast and to the plate. He is wearing gray baseball pants, a orange jersey with blue writing reading Astros and his number 56, and then a blue baseball cap with the H and the star that is the Houston Astros logo. And we'll start with our story. Ronel Blanco's brilliant start to the season is about the only thing going for the Houston Astros. Blanco threw 2024's first no-hitter, April 1st against Toronto, then made it to the 6th against Texas on Sunday before allowing a hit. The problem for the Astros is what's happened on days Blanco didn't pitch. They've only one victory aside from his two starts. After 7 straight AL Championship Series appearances, Houston is considered a World Series contender again this year, and the Astro record of 3-7 isn't worth panicking about. They've had a tough schedule facing the Yankees, Blue Jays, and Rangers, and their run differential of -4 isn't awful. Houston has been without Justin Verlander, currently on a rehab assignment working his way back from shoulder issues. Injuries to Verlander and Jose Urquidy helped Blanco get a spot in the rotation, and he's certainly made a positive contribution so far. Christian Javier has also made 2 scoreless starts, and Framber Valdez has been solid. The bullpen's been a different story. Houston relievers are 0-5 with a 6.89 ERA, with newcomer Josh Hader taking a couple of the losses. Central surprises. It's easy to overlook the AL and NL Central, but Pittsburgh is tied for the best record in baseball at 8-2. The Pirates started 20-8 last year, then quickly sank back under .500 and finished 10 games under. So, some skepticism is warranted, and the schedule was favorable early with series against Miami and Washington. But then Pittsburgh took 2 of 3 from Baltimore, with both wins coming in walk-off fashion. Rookie Jared Jones has struck out 17 in 11 2-3 innings for the Pirates in 2 starts. Just behind the Pirates at 6-2 are the Milwaukee Brewers, whose starters are 3-1 with a 2.72 ERA after the team traded Corbin Burns in the offseason. In the AL Central, Cleveland 7-2 is averaging nearly 6 runs a game, while Kansas City 6-4 has allowed only 25 in 10 games. Detroit 6-3 is right there near the top of the division as well. Line of the week. Blanco's no-hitter was the earliest in Major League history by date, beating the previous record of April 4th by 3 days. He struck out 7 and walked 2 in his 8th career start. It's the lone complete game in the big league so far this season. Comeback of the week. Spencer Strider's troublesome elbow is a big concern for the Atlanta Braves, but on the field so far, they are the only team above .500 in the NL East. They also have the best run differential in the National League. On Saturday, Atlanta allowed 6 runs in the top of the first inning, and when Arizona took an 8-2 lead in the fifth, the Braves had just a 2.2% chance to win, according to Baseball Savant. Atlanta cut the lead in half quickly on Marcell Ozuna's 3-run homer in the bottom of the fifth. Then the Braves scored twice in the seventh and twice in the eighth to win 9-8. 9-8. And then there's a photo here. Pittsburgh Edward Olivares, 38, celebrated after winning, hitting a walk-off fielder's choice, driving in 2 runs off Baltimore relief pitcher Yennier Cano during the bottom of the ninth inning on Sunday. It's a great photo of that number 38 player in a white pants and a white jersey with a black writing reading Pirates with his number 38. He's also wearing a black undershirt and a yellow glove. He has the batting helmet in his other hand, and all his teammates are running up to him. There's 3 of them hugging him and celebrating that big hit that was able to help them win that game. All right, and now we turn to another professional sport, but we're back with basketball. Milwaukee's up and down season reaches low point. The Milwaukee Bucks roller coaster season has hit its nadir with the playoffs less than 2 weeks away. The Bucks have lost 4 straight games and 6 of their past 7. They're 15-17 under coach Doc Rivers after going 32-14 before his arrival. Although Milwaukee, 47-31, has a 1-game lead over the Orlando Magic, 46-32, and the New York Knicks, 46-32, in the race for the number 2 seed in the Eastern Conference playoffs behind the Boston Celtics, the Bucks could be facing another early exit if they don't turn things around. Definitely not a good feeling, 2-time MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo said Sunday after the Bucks' 122-109 loss to the New York Knicks. Kind of the environment on the team doesn't feel right. Antetokounmpo then went into more detail regarding his comment about the environment. When you lose games, you don't feel good, he said, and you're not happy. If you go back home, you cannot sit down and watch Amazon Prime and be relaxed and enjoy your steak, or some guys who drink your wine or beer or whatever they drink, or in my case, do my Legos. When I try to put my Legos in place, I'm more frustrated and I'm hurting my fingers and stuff. That's what I mean by the environment not feeling good. We are not a losing team. We don't have that mentality. That's not in us. The Bucks have been through plenty of upheaval ever since they had the league's best regular season record last year, but lost to the Miami Heat in the first round of the playoffs. They fired coach Mike Budenholzer and acquired star guard Damian Lillard. Budenholzer was replaced by Adrian Griffin, who was dismissed midway through the season despite having a 30-13 record. Joe Prunty went 2-1 as an interim head coach before Rivers came aboard. The coaching change was an indication the Bucks weren't satisfied with their struggles on defense and uncomfortably close wins over losing teams during Griffin's brief tenure, but the inconsistency has continued under Rivers. The Bucks lost 7 of Rivers' first 10 games. They won 6 straight after the All-Star break. Now they're slumping again. These are the moments where you find out who's a real one and who's not, because everybody's going to be saying negative stuff, how wrong it is and how bad it is, Lillard said. You can fold or not fold. That's what we're going to learn about ourselves going into the playoffs based on the experiences we're having right now. And that concludes our final story. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 9th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Maria from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.